91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. When we consider feral critters in metropolitan areas, we usually think dogs, cats, and in our area, maybe an exotic bird or a canal gator. We hope most boas stay in the glades. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper. In general, cities now see lots more species and numbers. We'll visit with British journalist Tristan Donovan. His latest book is Feral Cities, Adventures with Animals in the Urban Jungle. He spent time in South Florida, including a view of our battle with the non-native great African snail. They eat anything, including the stucco on homes. Coyotes and foxes are common in cities, and some African locales even deal with urban leopards. Egad. Stay tuned. The Urban Wild Kingdom up next, after the news. And we're back with today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman returns from her symposium next week. So this hour we discuss the often unobserved realm of urban wildlife. Of course, sometimes these critters are closely observed and may be valued, tolerated, despised, and hunted. There are mammals, birds, reptiles, marsupials, insects, and spiders. So, from London, we're now joined by author Tristan Donovan. His latest book is Feral Cities, Adventures with Animals in the Urban Jungle. And he joins us from Brighton, UK, via Skype. Thanks for coming on, Tristan Donovan.
Thank you for having me.
Good evening to you. Your previous books were The History of Video Games and also the book How Soda Shook Up the World. I'd like to read that. But how did this feral critters idea come about?
Well, it started back when I was at university. My degree was in ecology. And one of the things I was always interested in, having grown up in London, was urban ecology and wildlife in the city and how it would behave differently. But this was sort of mid-90s, and it really was an area that ecologists and biologists didn't bother to look at. It was kind of, they would look at the city and go, well, that's not an environment worth knowing anything about, and tend to ignore it. So I never really explored it and went on to become a journalist. But when I was thinking of ideas for my next book after Fizz, there were lots of reports in the London newspapers about red foxes turning up in people's houses. It seemed like the fox population of London had sort of exploded, and there were headlines almost every other day about it. And that reminded me of my interest in urban ecology. So I thought, you know, let's go out, find out where wild foxes are there, and then what else is living in cities all over the world.
Tell the little story about the docent at one of our zoos about that. Kids don't get to see wild animals until they go to a zoo.
Oh, yes. One people I interviewed worked for Lincoln Park Zoo, and he was having a conversation with someone else who was saying how great it is. You know, we bring children to the zoo and then they get to actually see some animals, because usually they see nothing. And his point was, that's not true. We see animals every day, even though we've got very used to some of them. So feral pigeons, for example, they're in every city and we're very used to them, so much so that we tend to blank them out almost as wildlife. But there's lots out there. There's squirrels, all sorts. And in some ways, it's just a case of looking for it and actually paying attention rather than walking by or staring at your smartphone or something.
This topic has such wide emotions and opinion. Is one group's passion another's pest?
Yes, very, very much so. And I think you can never take the line that, you know, all urban wildlife is good. It's clearly not. People don't want to be overrun by rats and things like that. But I think it's more mixed picture. You get some people who have almost zero tolerance of any wildlife whatsoever. So, you know, a raccoon maybe knocks over their trash can, and you know, that's outrageous. It shouldn't be there. It needs to be removed. some people were quite welcoming, maybe too far in feeding them and encouraging them. So, you know, as many different people as you get in cities, there is many different opinions about what should be and shouldn't be in the city. But the animals don't care. They don't see our boundaries. If they can make it in the city, they're going to be there.
So just as our national parks, say Yellowstone or Everglades National Park here in South Florida, this feeding of animals is very treacherous in city life also for the animals.
Yeah, definitely, and potentially people as well. The thing is, it trains animals to expect food from people, so they become very dependent on the person who's feeding them. So if that person moves away, for example, that food source might stop, and because they're very used to relying on that, they might not be doing so well afterwards. But also it trains them to be tamer and less scared of people, and that can lead to situations where they expect everyone to feed them. So one example I was told about while researching the book in Los Angeles was coyotes being fed, and what happened as a result is they began expecting everyone to give them food. So they went up to this person in Griffith Park in Los Angeles and gave them a nip on their shin because they expect to get food from them. That's how coyotes communicate that. Those coyotes had to be caught and put down because, you know, they're potentially getting to a danger to people. And so feeding of wild animals can be dangerous both for people and for animals.
What kind of animals thrive best as wildlife in a city?
There tends to be several characteristics. One of them is they breed very fast on the whole. Cities are tough places to live in some ways. Roads are very dangerous for most animals. So if you can breed fast, it's less likely that your population is going to die out. Another advantage is to be small, because then you're less likely to be noticed. So if you're a grizzly bear, it's more likely someone's going to spot you and you're going to be dealt with. Whereas if you're a much smaller animal, you're more able to move around the city without being spotted by us. Other things that help is you have adaptable behavior. You can learn to cross roads or use storm drains to get around as raccoons do. And also just have a generalist diet. Don't be fussy about what you eat. If you want to be an animal that succeeds in a city, you should be able to eat all kinds of things and make do with what you find along the way.
And obviously, say in the mammal genre, they need to be smaller rather than large.
Yes, definitely. So it's very hard for things like mooses or bears to really establish populations in cities because we're going to see them all the time, whereas rats are very good at that because they can disappear into very small holes and are very much unseen. And this is one of the reasons why snakes also seem to be doing quite well in Miami, is that they spend most of their time hiding on the ground and in quite small spots. So they don't get seen very much.
We'll talk about your Miami-Dade trip just a little bit later, but we were saying that the small and adaptive tend to be, but you went to South Africa where they have a big problem with wild boars in the streets of cities.
In Berlin they have the problem.
Berlin, that's right,
boars.
Yeah. That seems odd.
Yes, it's a strange one. I mean, there's sort of various factors at work. I mean, Berlin's a very green city. There's lots of corridors and pathways. And over various decades, Berlin's been trying to connect all these up. So it's relatively easy for boars to move around. Also, they move out of the wilder areas to avoid hunters and move into the streets. But the other thing that's helped is people's front gardens have got lots of juicy things for them to eat. So it's an attractive food source. And then, of course, there are the people who are feeding them, which means, well, I'll leave the forest and I'll come onto the streets. So they're quite a common sight, particularly in the outskirts of Berlin, the sort of suburban kind of ring around it. Less so in the city centre, but they have turned up there too.
Here in Central Florida, we have a lot of wild boars. They're hunted. I'm not sure they're not the nemesis as the ones in Berlin, but I've read that they date back to they were originally brought by Ponce de Leon.
Wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know you had wild boars as well.
Oh yes.
One of the things about Miami is when they're expecting, oh, I'll get 2 or 3 animals, and like, oh, we got this, we got this, we got this, we got this. There's so much to actually see. There is so much wildlife in Miami-Dade. It's amazing for an urban area.
In fact, I think I did a promo for this program that said that South Florida sort of leads the league in the United States in exotic animals.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the climate, I guess. I mean, I don't think there's any reason why Miami is having more of these exotic species being introduced than any other city in the US. The difference is the subtropical climate means if they escape and there's enough to breed, they can survive very well in Miami. There's enough water and the temperature is nice.
You spent quite a bit of time all over the world, really, with people who are either officially charged with controlling or somehow dealing with these animals, and also there's a lot of volunteers that you went with. Tell us about your trip to Miami-Dade, and I think first you went about with the folks who are in charge of chickens, in feral chickens in Miami-Dade County, and it relates back to one of our city commissioners, Spence Jones.
Yes, is the neighborhood enforcement team, which is run by the city, and they have the job of going and trying to catch the problem feral chickens that are out in places like Little Haiti. And so I spent the morning with them on one of the days they go out with their great big green fishing nets to try and catch these birds. And the problems they cause is they tear up people's gardens, they're very loud, make mess. So when it gets sort of to an extent that they're getting out of control, that's when the team comes in and hopefully catches them. And it's quite fun, to be honest, kind of running through the streets with these nets trying to catch them, although it's a very kind of difficult way to do it. But this has been sort of a problem for ages. I can't remember the exact figure, but they reckon thousands, possibly tens of thousands of feral chickens are wandering around the city.
Now, when they catch them, what happens to the chickens?
They get taken to a farm on the outskirts of Miami, apparently to live out the rest of their life. So it's not too bad to be a chicken that's captured. You're not left to struss around the streets. You get to hang out on a farm for the rest of your life.
Now, of course, in our area, those chickens can also be related to a couple of religious rituals.
Yes.
The voodoo and the Santeria.
Yeah, so their connection with that is sort of one of the reasons that this population has got so big, that people bring in chickens for those rituals. And it's not always a case of the birds get killed as part of it. They get released after being used in the rituals. So, but because of that, people who believe in that don't want anything done to the chickens, or don't want to deal with them because they believe they're part of a ritual and it's a bad thing to mess with those chickens. There are other factors as well. Some of the cultures, it's a case of people have a tradition of keeping chickens for food or for their eggs or for the meat, and so want to keep chickens there to eat at some point. And also, they get used in cockfighting as well. So these kind of cultural things are part of the reason these chickens have got so out of control in Miami.
We're speaking with Tristan Donovan. He's the author of the book Feral Cities: Adventures with Animals in the Urban Jungle. We'll come back and we'll talk about South Florida snakes and the giant African snail after this. And it is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and author Tristan Donovan. We're talking about his book, Feral Cities: Adventures with Animals in the Urban Jungle. Tristan, I imagine you were pretty amazed by the numbers of exotic snakes, including the pythons. Tell us about your experience with the people who are trying to control this problem.
Yeah, so the people, it was amazing the amount of different snakes that you've got. But people I went to meet are doing a research project to try and learn how boa constrictors behave in the area, and hopefully through that develop better ways of trapping them. So we went out to find one of these boas, and they've got a tagging them that helps them track locate where it is. And have to admit, when I was and this is in Deering Estate, and as I was going there, is one of those moments where you kind of think, I've never seen a snake outside a zoo. And now I'm going to find a boa constrictor. It was quite sort of a tense moment because you end up sort of literally on top of the snake because it hides in the undergrowth. So you're walking back and forth with this track again. It's here, it's exactly here. And then suddenly it jumps out from the undergrowth and goes slithering off. But it was great to see that. And I think, you know, it highlights sort of how much understanding we still have to get about how snakes behave in urban areas, because these populations are quite new and no one really knows how they behave differently to the wild, and it's a big concern.
I believe when we have rather cold winters here, that does put a little bit of a damper on those snake populations, the non-native snakes.
Yes, that will definitely help, and it's sort of one of the reasons we don't have similar problems here in the UK, because we're rainier and colder than Seattle most of the time. So, you know, nothing's really going to thrive. So when you have those sort of cold snaps, that's going to sort of keep the reptiles a bit in check. But they've been here for years, so it's unlikely that it will wipe them all out. It will just reduce their numbers.
Now, also during your visit in our area, you really got to see the makings of what could possibly be some really, really hardy escargot.
Yes, the giant African land snails. So you've probably, if you're in South Florida, you've probably seen the photos of these big snails. They get to about 8 inches big, and as their name suggests, they come from Africa around sort of Nigeria originally. But a couple back in 2011, they turned up in Miami, in Coral Gables, and in vast numbers. So they've probably been breeding for some time already. And these are a real problem for the area. First of all, they do eat sort of the calcium off houses through scuttle, but they also carry something called rat lungworm disease, which is very nasty nematode that can cause meningitis. And they lay tons and tons of eggs, thousands of eggs. They breed incredibly fast. And the big worry for the Florida Department of Agriculture is that not only are they causing problems in the city, but they're going to expand out and start eating everything in the Everglades and destroying the agriculture of Florida. So these are a really serious problem for the area. And it might sound laughable, sort of, you know, snails move so slowly, but when they're this big and breed that fast and eat that much, they are quite a danger.
If there's some reason you need to pick one of them up, it's very strongly suggested you use some sort of covering for your hand, because you could wipe your eyes or mouth or something and be in big trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to get rat lungworm disease. It's probably even nastier than the name suggests. It can be fatal. And even if you get it and do recover, there can be sort of lifelong complications. So, you know, definitely get on some gloves if you're going to get rid of snails.
Tristan, I have an emailer here who experienced something that you've talked about in your book, and that's about urban critters and traffic lights. He says, I just wanted to relay a funny story about chickens I saw at my supermarket area. We have a chicken who every morning crosses the street at the light and actually waits for the light to turn green before going across the street.
Wow.
Can they distinguish that color? I guess they can somehow. Or is it just the traffic slowing, possibly?
It may be the traffic slowing. I don't know how chickens' eyes work well enough, but I know with researchers in Chicago who look at coyotes have seen that they've learned how to cross roads and wait for the lights. They've got very poor color vision, so they think it's not that they're seeing the lights change, it's that they're seeing the pattern of the traffic stopping and know they've got a certain amount of time to cross. So they're learning it through that rather than going, oh, it's gone green, I can go now.
I think you related that the chickens here in Miami were at least smart enough to be able to tell when the worker's truck would pull up, the ones that were trying to net them and take them out to that farm.
Yeah, they've got wise to it. They turned up in the van, and it's a sort of white pickup type van, and the chickens scarper. And also, when they see those green gnats, they do shriek and start running. So they've seen them enough now, I think, and seen them sort of obviously catch a few of their pals, to know that these people are after us.
Perhaps we have listeners who'd like to add to our conversation. You're certainly welcome. Give us a call, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Let's move on to the great American Midwest and the city of Indianapolis and the tremendous efforts that have been made to keep these starlings under control,
Yes,
or at least avert them from the city.
Yeah, the European starlings. And this happens with other cities as well, but in Indianapolis is prime example. And every winter, European starlings decide we're going to come and roost in the city. And the numbers get up to about 150,000 try to descend. And they want to go and stay in downtown. So imagine that many birds. They're very loud birds, squawking all the time. And the amount of mess they leave is quite a lot. And they've had periods where, people would have to leave offices with umbrellas, even in the middle, even when it's not raining, to avoid being splattered. So it became a real problem. And in downtown, it was putting off tourists and so on. So they've been sort of waging this war really against the starlings to try and scatter them away and keep them out of downtown. And they do this by a number of ways. They got sort of laser pens to try and scare them, bits of wood that they clap together to frighten them with noise. And when things get too bad, they use fireworks. They have two types of fireworks that they shoot at them. And it sounds like a gun going off. So, I mean, they have little signs up everywhere saying, if it's this time of year and you're hearing gunshots, don't panic. It's probably this.
I have an emailer here, May. She says at Fuchs Park in South Miami and at the Veterans Park in Pinecrest, there used to be a large population of Muscovy ducks there, but the more aggressive ibis have taken over. They no longer approach people to beg for food. I wonder if they aren't being caught and eaten too. My cousin came to visit from Cape Cod and was charmed by the ibis, but did a double take of the ducks. Are those Muscovy? He was very surprised.
That's interesting. Whereabouts is that?
In South Miami.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Again, our number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. Now, we were talking about Indianapolis and those starlings. For those, we have, I guess every American city has big populations of those starlings that roost, but they're the ones that. There are hundreds and hundreds of them flying, say, just before dusk, before they roost, I suppose, and they all move in a direction at the same time. It's really something to behold, the way
Oh,
they do that.
yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. They're called murmurations, and they're almost like clouds of birds that kind of wobble and stretch and move around. It's amazing sight to see. And they are pretty birds. It's the volume of them is the issue, really. But the murmurations are an amazing. How they avoid crashing into each other is a marvel.
And now that shifting in unison has an evolutionary reason, correct?
Yes, and it's to avoid predators. So the starlings are regularly in Brighton near me in the winter, and they do that. And that's because there's some falcons that live on tower block nearby. And so it's to confuse them and make sure they can't actually catch any birds. Because if there's so many birds moving at once, it's very hard for a predator to home in on one bird and get hold of it. So it confuses them, makes it harder to catch all of them.
There'll be sometimes maybe a couple of thousand of them roosting on high tension wires, the electrical lines overhead.
Yeah, and so that can cause power outages. I mean, they do congregate in very large numbers when allowed to. They're definitely an animal that feels we've got safety in numbers, and it does work, except when USDA comes along to scare them away.
Well, Tristan Donovan is joining us. He's the author of Feral Cities, Adventures with Animals in the Urban Jungle. Let's take a short break. We'll be back with more. And we're back, 33 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman will be rejoining us on Monday. And Tristan Donovan, we have another caller, and this is something you address in the book, and people who live here in South Florida just figure that these critters, and they can be quite beautiful, are actually native, but they aren't. Anita in Davie, hi.
Hi. I have a question about iguanas. They are everywhere. They eat everything, and I can't figure out how to keep them out of my yard. I want to make a garden, but it seemed impossible. They eat flowers. I spent so much money on flowers. Any suggestions?
Tristan, Davie is sort of a rural suburb in Broward County.
It's quite hard to know. I've not sort of dealt with iguana problems directly, but I guess it's how secure your garden is. I mean, the thing is, they're good at climbing as well, so I'm not quite sure what would put them off. I guess it's, you know, the less accessible your garden is to them, that's probably the only way you can keep them out. I mean, they are pests and they do like eating flowers. It's rather difficult to know what to advise, I'm afraid.
But they also dig like right alongside of the house, like they burrow and under or something. And they're just a huge pest. I wish there was some way that, you know, maybe the city or county could get rid of them.
Yeah, I think the thing I was told is the population got so big that it's now uncontrollable. It's almost impossible to eradicate them. But it may be possible the animal control may have some advice that it could offer on how to try and keep them out, what kind of fencing or something like that will kind of stop them. I know certainly some places do advise on that. I don't know particularly how you deal with those lizards.
How large are the ones that you have, Anita?
Well, they get like, I've seen them as large as about 6 inches, and then I've seen other ones that are brown that look like cats. They're so huge, but I understand that they're not officially, that the brown ones are not officially iguanas, but they're related to them. So they multiply quickly, very quickly.
As you stated earlier, Tristan, that's what an attribute that urban critters have is they do reproduce quickly. Anita, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Tristan?
Yeah.
Okay, you're still there.
Yeah. yes, certainly. Sorry, I thought you were about
what the attributes of animals that if they reproduce quickly, they can be very adaptive in our cities.
Yes, and I mean, a good example of this is the opossum. They live very short amounts of time, a couple of years, 3 years if they're very lucky. And one of the things that means they've managed to actually build up in cities is that they breed so fast. They just pump out babies like there's no tomorrow. And for them, there isn't. So that really helps with animals in urban areas. The faster you can breed, the more likely it is you are going to survive and build a large population and not be able to get rid of, like the iguanas.
Well, in a discussion such as this, we really can't ignore the legendary rat population in New York City, and you studied that also.
Yes, so the rats are obviously there, maybe not in the numbers that people think of. There's the old saying that in London you're never more than 6 foot away from a rat, or and it's based on some very dodgy figures from the early 1900s. The basically never looked at cities and basically just went around asking people, do you think it's likely there's at least one rat per acre? He was very kind of back of the envelope type figure. So they're not as populous as people think, but obviously cities are good for them and they do well there. They actually tend to be healthier in cities, less disease ridden than they do in the wild. So rats are great urban adapters. They've got all our sewers and so on to roam around in. So they're very good at city life, and they've been travelling with us for centuries now. They follow us, and they do quite well in hanging around us.
Now, also, while you're in New York City, if you study the rats, you also need to study the cockroaches. And you found out from some of the experts that there are even DNA. The DNA is evolving in different directions from various areas of the city. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, certainly. Basically, this study is looking at the DNA signature of the cockroaches in different parts of Manhattan. So they gathered up these American cockroaches from all over, say, Upper West Side and Greenwich Village and so on, and had a look at their DNA and compared it. And what they found is these are separate populations. There's not any mixing between them. They've arrived at different points. They live in different sewer networks, possibly even very close together. But because there's no route to connect, say two sewer systems don't link up, they don't get to interbreed. So you've got these almost sort of different tribes of American cockroaches in Manhattan in different places. So you know, they're all the same species, but there are distinct differences that are notable on a genetic level. So there are sort of different populations, which is interesting because we think of them as all the same, or you know, a cockroach is a cockroach, but in Manhattan they're very different cockroaches.
Tell us about the scientist that was studying the New York cockroaches and having people mail in bodies of roaches that I guess they had squished or something. But is it legal to send dead cockroaches in the U.S. mail?
Apparently. You wouldn't have thought it, but he did check, and it is. So it's a citizen science type project. So he put out a call and saying, you know, if you find a roach, can you stick it in an envelope and send it to us? And before doing so, he checked with the Postal Service, and they said, well, yeah, it's fine. It's not necessarily a kind of disease carrier, and it's not kind of breaking any laws. So, yeah, you can do. So went to visit him, he actually had some envelopes that had just arrived and opened it up, and sure enough, there's squished cockroaches inside. And that's his mailbag every day.
Well, in your trip to South Florida, since you did go out and learn more about some of our exotic wildlife, and you've studied cockroaches, didn't anyone show you the famous palmetto bug of South Florida?
I'm afraid not.
They're big. They're big.
And these are the ones that hiss, right?
And they fly.
I wish I got to see them. I'm probably the only person who's ever wanted to see them.
Well, I'm glad I can say you can come to my house and see them, but they're probably there somewhere, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that was one of the amazing things about Miami when I was doing the initial calls for the research. I was phoning up again. Well, you know, other cities would be like, what do you have? So, oh, we're Berlin, we've got wild boars, or we're London, we've got red foxes. Miami, it's like, well, where do we start? We've got tegus, we've got boa constrictors, we've got iguanas. It's such a big list, Nile monitors, and there's so many things that you could probably have filled the whole book.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with Tristan Donovan, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Also email radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Let's go over to another continent and tell us about the leopards. Oh, my Lord. They're in cities in Dubai.
In India, in Mumbai.
In India, I'm sorry. Yeah. Mumbai, not Dubai. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So they tend to be on the outskirts, and they're present. They're not noticed too often. But yeah, it's a slightly terrifying thought to have a leopard wandering around your city. So they seem to, the idea is they seem to be drawn by things like wild feral dogs running around the city, or feral pigs. And so that's drawing them in. There's prey there for them to get to. And it may also be that they're getting a bit more used to the busyness of the city. And don't forget, Indian cities have grown enormously, very, very quickly in the past 20 years. So the city space is encroaching much more on areas where once they would have roamed free. So it's quite a terrifying prospect. And there have been incidents in various Indian cities with leopards in cities, sometimes people killing the leopards, sometimes leopards attacking people after being cornered. But one of the interesting things they found is that when people spot a leopard that hasn't caused any problems and they remove that leopard and say take it into a national park, what tends to happen is younger leopards that are less familiar with people and maybe a bit more aggressive move in, and they can actually be more dangerous than the leopard that was just sneaking around, not really causing anyone any problems.
So with some of the larger carnivores that move into cities, does the food chain begin with garbage dumps? The animals that feed on the garbage, and then the animals that feed on the animals that feed on the garbage.
Yes, so I guess that would be the process here. So you'll have the dogs that will come for the trash, then obviously you would have the leopards that come for the dogs. And I must stress this on sort of the outskirts of the city, it's not kind of right in the heart of it. So leopards are really kind of moving from rural areas into urban areas and back again. So they're kind of mixing and matching, but there's enough prey there thanks to the dogs and the pigs to make it worth their while.
Well, while I ponder a leopard trotting down the street, we're going to take a short break on Topical Currents. We'll return with author Tristan Donovan in a moment. And it is Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Tristan Donovan. He's joining us from England via Skype. And his book is Feral Cities: Adventures with Animals in the Urban Jungle. We have some lines open, 1-800-743-9576. Also, you can chime in via email. That's radio@wlrn.org. Next on our caller line, it's Eddie in Coral Gables. Hey, Eddie.
Hi, thanks, Joe. I've seen lots of exotic species around Grove and Gables, but I'd heard about roosters. But the other day near 17th Avenue and Flagler, there was a rooster. I was wondering if he might know which type, because we chased it out of around from a dumpster. It flew up to a fence and then flew over a two-story apartment building like a pheasant or a partridge, and no wonder they're hard to catch.
I didn't think chickens could fly that well.
I didn't either.
Yeah, it doesn't sound... I don't think pheasants can fly that well. That doesn't sound surprising.
I saw
super rooster.
Eddie, I saw some really feral behavior in my neighborhood in Miami Lakes. I think there was a dead squirrel in the road, and two vultures flew in and were taking apart that carcass. It was really something to see that the vultures were actually there on the city street going at it.
Well, this one was very aggressive, was making an aggressive sound back at you, and then it flew like that. I was just dumbfounded.
Wow. Okay. Thanks for your call. And we move along to Fort Lauderdale caller. This is Fred. Hi, Fred.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Yes, two things. One about the roosters in the States. Chickens and roosters, especially the white ones, were bred to have stubby wings and short feathers, so they couldn't fly. But these roosters come up from the Caribbean, and they can't even fly like that. Yeah. So the other thing I was wondering, has anybody tried to come up with some kind of a trap, something that would attract these huge snails And when they eat it, it's a poison to their system, because they're going to take over if we don't do something quick.
Yeah, now there used to be a remedy for smaller snails in your garden. You could pour like a little cup of beer or something, and they would drown in that.
Right, yeah. Right. But the bigger ones don't get fooled by that, I guess, huh?
Yeah. Well, what the agriculture department's been doing is using pesticides, basically. So once a place has been spotted, they go and spray it with this molluscicide that kills most of them, and then go in and clean up the bodies and find any ones that are left. So they have been using that, but it's tended to rely, I think it's quite a powerful one, so it's tending to rely on people letting them know that they've spotted these snails, and then them coming along and dealing with it. But they're very keen to get rid of them.
And isn't there some ritual use of those snails as well?
Yes, in Yoruba religion, which is a African religion, if you're sort of on the more strict side of the religion, well, all parts of that religion use snails in rituals, but the stricter ones will only use the giant African land snails, because that is what would have been used originally in Africa. So that's what they think is the reason why they've ended up here, that they've probably been brought in for a ritual or something like that. That seems the theory, but I mean, there are other routes. They may have got across on a boat, or someone might have bought them as pets and then let them loose, and that certainly happened past in 1966. There was another outbreak, in a much smaller one in Miami, and that came from a boy who collected some in Hawaii, put them in a tank, they bred like crazy, and so they threw them out into the backyard, and a couple of years later you got thousands of them.
Okay, Fred, thanks for that clarifying that chicken stuff.
Thanks. You're welcome. Thank you very
okay.
much.
Okay. Thank you. And we go to Tom in Miami. Hey, Tom.
It's ironic, because when I was a young boy in Chicago in the 80s, we were selling giant African land snails as pets. What's interesting to me now is rural diseases, like as an example, schistosomiasis, or things that carry schistosomiasis, like snails, are actually entering the pet trade more and more now from places that we know are hotspots for human diseases. So essentially, rural diseases are being brought into our homes in our aquaria, and I didn't know if you knew about that.
Yeah, well, I think the pet trade sort of obviously a big source for these exotics. I don't know if rat lungworm was,
or people buy a little snake and then when it gets to be 10 or 12 feet long, they realize they can't deal with it.
Well, in this case, you're talking about, let's say, we'll talk about something called rabbit snails that are in pet shops right now, that a person at the CDC has told me directly that they are carrying in their bodies schistosomiasis, which is the second most expensive disease on Earth next to malaria.
Ooh.
And yet there doesn't seem to be any regulation hindering these things from coming in and bringing the diseases with them and entering into our homes, which just seems confounding.
Yeah, I know certainly the giant African land snails, there are restrictions on them, but I guess I can't explain why they cracked down on that as well. I guess
that was an agricultural defense. That was a defense of our agriculture that actually caused that. But there actually is no rule or regulation on hand that says if it happens to be a known Ebola carrier, as a random example, you can't import it. No such regulation exists.
Wow.
It wouldn't seem like an African snail or a snail of any sort would be a very dynamic pet, but...
Well, I mean, you can. There are people out there that keep anything you can think of that's alive, including microbes. There are bug chasers, the people that keep different strains of human pathogens as an odd example.
And they're low maintenance as well.
That reminds me, Tristan, thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you.
That reminds me, Tristan, that you have a section in the book that talks about that there really is a wild kingdom in everyone's home, especially in the carpet. Tell us about that.
Yes, so I went to Raleigh in North Carolina, and at North Carolina State University, they've been doing research into what insects and other arthropods live within our homes. And it's actually a really understudied area. Right? Our knowledge about what lives there and how it interacts with each other is very much unknown. So they were going in, sampling people's houses, spending a couple of hours hoovering up every insect they could find to work out what lives in there. And, you know, then there are certainly lots of evidence of, you know, animals that do succeed by living in our homes. And I guess from an insect's perspective, our homes are like caves, essentially. So you get things like the camel cricket, which has spread across. Now there's a North American one, but these researchers found a Japanese one that has, unknown to anyone else, just been spreading from basement to basement across the north east of the US. So there's lots of stuff going on in our homes. The trouble is we don't really understand it very well.
And that little spider that maybe builds a small web in the corner, I read in your book, can live for months or even a year without catching anything.
Yeah. They
don't require water.
Yeah, what they do is they close up basically their air holes, and that stops water escaping. And it's almost like sort of suspended animation, I guess. And so particularly, you know, it just helps them survive in dry climates and until the conditions get better. So spiders are very good at surviving in those kind of worlds.
I guess they're not harmful. I guess they do catch some little, really little critters or...
Yeah, I certainly imagined that our houses would be much more bug-ridden if it wasn't for the spiders.
Okay. And let's try Tyler in Coconut Grove. Hi there.
Hi. I just had a question. Just talking about the starlings in Indianapolis, how they're, you know, clapping bits of wood or fireworks. I mean, birds seem pretty smart. Won't they figure out eventually that that doesn't harm them, and then isn't the only solution to, you know, get a guy with a shotgun out there or try and...
I think they keep changing the scare tactics. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's how they've been doing it. So they won't use any to excess. So the fireworks are kept very much as a last resort, for example. And the idea is to keep mixing up and use different techniques to keep them on their toes and just keep changing their approach so they can't work out all... And basically the message becomes that you go to downtown, who knows what's going to happen? Something a bit freaky is going to happen. You're going to want to leave. So that's the tactic they're trying to instill by using as many different methods as they can.
I found out something in your book that I never really thought of, but it does make sense. Is the, of course, it's the bird waste that causes so much problems, and it's very acidic. So it tends to etch paint and metals. And it's so acidic is because birds can't have the weight of a urinary system because of the flight. They need to have it to be very light.
Yeah, you don't want to be carrying a full bladder while you're trying to fly through the air. It's you want to get rid of the excess weight. So, they have it very concentrated.
Well, it's certainly been very interesting speaking with you. We've been joined by author Tristan Donovan. He's the author of Feral Cities, Adventures with Animals in the Urban Jungle. And we certainly thank you for appearing on our program, Tristan.
Thank you for having me.
And sorry to those callers we couldn't get on the air. If you didn't catch the whole program, like to hear more, we have free audio downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from Paul Leary, additional assistance from Michael Stock. And we have more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop a like when you visit us. And tomorrow's Topical Currents is with chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gassenheimer. We'll have an experienced allergy specialist on hand to speak about food allergies. If you have questions about allergies, we'll be in our At Your Service mode on Topical Currents. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.